In my first lecture, we looked at the world of early American Orthodoxy, a world in which Orthodox affiliation and actual observance were often not the same thing. Orthodox rabbis in the first half of the 20th century were operating in a very different environment from their European predecessors. They did not have strong communal enforcement structures, and they were serving Jews in a voluntary religious marketplace. In that setting, rabbis often focused less on strict enforcement and more on keeping Jews connected. Their role expanded significantly beyond classical halachic decision making. The American Orthodox rabbi became a teacher, a communicator, a public figure, and a communal leader who had to hold together communities that were religiously diverse, socially mobile, and often only partially observant. In many cases, the rabbi functioned less as an enforcer of boundaries and more as a stabilizer of identity. At the same time, the boundary between Orthodoxy and Conservative Judaism was not yet clearly drawn. There was extensive overlap in people, institutions, and synagogue life. Many congregations did not understand themselves as choosing between two competing denominations. Instead, they often saw themselves as simply traditional synagogues trying to respond to the pressures and opportunities of American life. Conservative Judaism in its early decades did not present itself as a break from Orthodoxy. It presented itself as a moderated continuation of traditional Judaism, an attempt to preserve core commitments while adjusting form and practice where necessary. Over time, however, that in-between space became harder to sustain. As conservative Judaism developed its own institutions and began issuing independent halachic decisions, and as Orthodoxy gradually responded by clarifying its own standards more sharply, the relationship between the two movements slowly shifted. What had once been a fluid continuum began to harden into two separate denominations. That process, slow, uneven, and often not fully recognized at the time, is the focus of this year: how the split developed, what forces drove it, and how it reshaped the modern Orthodox rabbinate in itself. On a side note, in this lecture and my previous one, I made little mention of the Young Israel movement. I may reference it briefly here or there. That is not because I do not view Young Israel as central to the growth of modern Orthodoxy in America during this period. Rather, my focus here is specifically on how the modern Orthodox rabbinate changed from the first half to the second half of the 20th century. And in that context, I didn't think Young Israel was central to the story I'm trying to tell. In particular, we will see a major transformation. The modern Orthodox rabbi moves from a model centered on accommodation, flexibility, and maintaining affiliation towards a model that increasingly emphasizes boundary making, institutional development, and strengthening halachic commitment as a defining feature of communal life. The founding and early development of the Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS, is central for understanding this entire story. One of the most important corrections to popular assumptions about American Jewish history is that Orthodoxy and Conservative Judaism were never clearly separate from the beginning. The early decades show something much more fluid and ambiguous. Many rabbis and lay leaders still imagine the possibility of a unified American Judaism that would remain fundamentally committed to tradition, even if required adaptation. JTS officially opened on January 2nd, 1887, and described itself as an institution for Jews of America faithful to Mosaic law and ancestral tradition. Its founding was largely a response to the growing influence of Reform Judaism, especially after the 1885 Pittsburgh Platform, which rejected many traditional ritual obligations that defined Judaism primarily as an ethical system. But it is crucial to understand what JTS was not. It was not founded as a separate denomination. It was a coalition project. It brought together rabbis and lay leaders who had real disagreements about modernity, but who shared one basic conviction: traditional Judaism needed institutional strength if it was going to survive in America. That coalition was very diverse. It included Sephardic rabbis such as Rabbi Sabato Moraes of Mikveh Yisrael and Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendez of Sheirit Yisrael, alongside figures like Alexander Kohat and Marcus Jastrow, who represented a middle position between classical rabbinic learning and academic Jewish scholarship. Many of these early figures would today be described as early forms of what later became modern Orthodoxy. Henry Pereira Mendez is a particularly important example. He came from a deeply traditional Sephardic background in London, but also lived a life of broad engagement with the modern world. He studied medicine in a secular university, interacted with Christians and non-Orthodox Jews, and was active in civic life, all while maintaining full halakhic observance. For many early supporters of JTS, this was the model they hoped to build in America, a Judaism that remained fully loyal to halakha while participating confidently in modern society. At the same time, there were real disagreements among these founders about issues such as mixed seating, synagogue decorum, meaning questions about the language and style of prayer, the use of music in English sermons, expectations of formality and participation in the service, and the overall feel of the synagogue, and the boundaries of ritual change. But in the face of Reformed Judaism, those disagreements were often pushed into the background. What united them was stronger than what divided them. In its early years, JTS remained small and financially fragile. During its first 15 years, it graduated only 14 rabbis and 3 cantors. It operated on a limited budget, supported by a mix of traditionalist Jews, including East European immigrants. Even Rav Yaakov Yosef contributed financially. Still, many Orthodox leaders remained cautious. They were concerned about the seminary's openness to academic scholarship and its unusually broad ideological coalition. In 1898, several leaders connected to JTS, including Pereira Mendez, Cyrus Adler, Bernard Drachman, and Max Cohen, joined with East European rabbis and 47 congregations to form the Orthodox Union. The OU emerged primarily as a response to Reform Judaism and the Pittsburgh Platform. It was not yet a sharply defined ideology. It was a practical organizational response that emphasized Shabbos, Kashrus, Jewish education, and resistance to missionary activity. And even with the OU and JTS existing side by side, there was still no clear sense that Orthodoxy and what would become conservative Judaism were two separate worlds. Most people still thought in terms of Reform versus traditional Judaism, not competing traditional denominations. That begins to change with the arrival of Solomon Schechter in 1902. Schechter was one of the most respected Jewish scholars in the English-speaking world. He combined deep traditional learning with elite academic scholarship and had gained international fame through his work on the Cairo Geniza in Cambridge. His arrival completely transformed JTS. Schechter brought funding, institutional strength, academic prestige, and organizational stability. But his most important contribution was conceptual. His model of Judaism was based on historical Judaism and the idea of Catholic Israel. Judaism develops over time, but legitimate change must reflect the lived religious experience of the Jewish people as a whole, not simply the decision of individual scholars or rabbis. This allowed Schechter to hold together tradition and change without sharply defining boundaries. Just as important was his leadership style. As historian Michael Cohen and others have emphasized, Schechter built the movement less through ideology and more through personality, loyalty, and institutional charisma. The conservative movement at this stage was held together more by attachment to Schechter and a shared sense of mission than by clear doctrinal definition. That broad vision also shaped the creation of the United Synagogue of America in 1913. Schechter supported it in part because JTS needed a congregational base similar to what Reformed Judaism already had. At the same time, the Orthodox Union was not supporting JTS, and many Orthodox rabbis were uneasy with changes being introduced in conservative synagogues to appeal to younger American Jews. The name itself, United Synagogue, reflected an ambition modeled after England, to create a central mainstream American Judaism that could unify traditional Jews and become the dominant religious expression of American Jewry. The goal was not separation, but consolidation. That vision did not ultimately succeed, but it reveals how unclear denominational thinking still was. The early platform of the United Synagogue sounds in many ways strikingly close to early modern Orthodoxy. It emphasized loyalty to Torah, continuity of tradition, observance of Shabbos and Kashrus, preservation of liturgy, and investment in Jewish education. In the 1920s, conservative and modern Orthodox leaders often used very similar language. Both were deeply concerned about Jewish youth losing connection, and both argued that Judaism needed to be made meaningful within American life. At this stage, differences were relatively modest. They were often about style rather than substance. English sermons, synagogue decorum, educational methods, and engagement with American culture. But over time, those differences widened. For much of the early 20th century, Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism remain deeply intertwined. This is not accidental. It reflected shared personnel, overlapping communities, and a long reluctance on both sides to define sharp boundaries. This overlap continued well into the mid-century period. Orthodox rabbis often served conservative congregations. Many rabbis moved fluidly between institutions. Many congregations that later became clearly conservative originally identified as modern Orthodox. In the interwar years, synagogues such as the Brooklyn Jewish Center and Congregation Adath Israel were often viewed by their own members as simultaneously Orthodox and conservative. That was not confusion. It was simply a world without rigid denominational lines. This becomes especially clear in the attempted merger of 1926 between JTS and Yeshiva University, then Yeshiva College and Reitz. At that time, both institutions were financially struggling, and many still saw them as part of one traditional Jewish world opposed to Reform Judaism. Leaders at JTS supported the idea, and even some within Yeshiva's lay leadership considered it seriously. The fact that such a merger was even imaginable shows how much shared identity still existed. But it ultimately failed because leading Orthodox rabbis began to recognize deeper ideological differences. Bernard Revel, founding president of Yeshiva University, and his mentors in the Agudath HaRabbanim strongly opposed it. For them, the differences were not institutional. They were fundamental differences in Torah, Halacha, and rabbinic authority. One issue was the educational method. Critics argued that JTS studied Talmud in an academic and analytical way, when Yeshiva students engaged in immersive traditional learning. As it was often put, JTS students studied about the Talmud, while Yeshiva students studied the Talmud itself. Another issue was theological direction. Mordechai Kaplan's presence at JTS became a symbol of growing ambiguity and ideological drift. But perhaps most importantly, the institutions had different missions. JTS trained rabbis for synagogue life. Yeshiva aimed to build an entire Orthodox civilization grounded in Torah learning for both clergy and laity. Still, even after the failed merger, overlap continued. In 1938, five of JTS's eight ordainees had studied at Yeshiva. Well into the 1950s, a significant percentage of JTS students came from Orthodox homes or had Orthodox training. Institutional separation did not immediately produce full social separation. By the post-war period, however, the landscape of conservative Judaism shifted sharply. What had begun under Salman Schechter as a broad and intentionally inclusive vision of traditional Judaism in America gradually moved towards a much more self-conscious identity. Conservative Judaism now understood itself as a distinct third denomination between Orthodoxy and Reform. To understand this shift, we need to begin not with institutions, but with ideas, specifically a change in how halachic authority itself was understood. Schechter had articulated his approach through the idea of Catholic Israel. By this, he meant that halachic authority is rooted not only in texts and rabbinic rulings, but in the lived religious practice of the Jewish people as a whole, the collective body of Knesset Yisrael. The original meaning Catholic comes from the Greek Katholikos, meaning universal, the entire Jewish people as a living organism, not rabbis alone, not institutions alone, or any one sect or school. In this model, the developing consensus of traditional Jewish community carries real halachic weight. Rabbinic authority is therefore primarily responsive. It gives formal expression to patterns that have already taken root in the broader life of the traditional community. Change in this framework is validated when it reflects when the community has already in practice come to accept what the community has already come to accept. But alongside this, another model becomes increasingly important in conservative thinking, Zacharia Frankel's positive historical school. See, Frankel was a 19th century rabbinic scholar in Central Europe. He lived from 1801 to 1875, and he served as the founding figure behind what became the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, Germany. That seminary was designed as a kind of middle path between strict traditional rabbinic training and the emerging academic study of Judaism in the modern university. Frankel himself was committed to halachic observance, but he also believed that Jewish law had to be understood historically with attention to how it developed over time. From there, Frankel shares with Schechter the basic premise that halacha develops within history, but he shifts the emphasis. In his framework, rabbinic leadership plays a far more active role. Rabbis are not only describing communal practice, they are also shaping it. They can interpret halacha in light of historical change, goddess development, and at times even advocate and implement change before it has been broadly accepted by the entire traditional community, including Orthodox Jewry. Authority in this model is not only reflective of consensus, it can form consensus over time. Once that shift takes place, the practical implications are significant. Under Schechter's Catholic Israel, it is difficult to justify halachic change that has not already been broadly accepted by the traditional Jewish community as a whole. But under a Frankel-style positive historical approach, conservative rabbis could now argue that they were authorized to advocate and introduce change even when that change had not yet been embraced by Orthodoxy or by the wider traditional world. In other words, halachic authority is no longer about recognizing consensus. It becomes about helping to create it. And once that intellectual shift is in place, we can see it quickly reflected in institutional developments. In 1948, Conservative Judaism establishes the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, which becomes the central halakhic authority of the movement. Alongside this, the movement begins producing authoritative liturgical materials that standardize conservative prayer life and gives it a more unified religious identity. These are not just technical changes. They signal that conservative Judaism is now operating with its own institutional halakhic infrastructure. That independence becomes fully visible just a few years later. In 1950, the movement rules that driving to synagogue on Shabbos is permissible under certain conditions. At that point, the conservative Judaism is no longer primarily seeking Orthodox approval or operating within a shared traditional framework. Is functioning as an independent halakhic authority in its own right. And once that happens, the relationship with Orthodoxy begins to change very quickly. At the same time, tensions between the movements increase. Orthodox critics become more uneasy with conservative willingness to tolerate practices they see as halakhically problematic, while conservative leaders become more open to diversity, experimentation, and adaptation within religious life. Two issues in particular, aguna and mixed seating, become major flashpoints, and they make these abstract differences very concrete. The aguna issue, especially after World War I, emerges as a serious communal problem. Rabbi Louis Epstein, a JTS graduate who had studied in Slobodka, proposed a halachic solution based on the principle of agency, or shlichut. He suggests that at the time of the marriage, the groom authorizes a beit din to act on his behalf in issuing a get, if necessary, in the future. Epstein argues that this is not a new halachic invention, but an application of existing principles already found within the tradition. At first, the proposal even receives tentative support within the conservative rabbinical assembly, but Orthodox leaders respond strongly. The Agudat HaRabbanim, including Bernard Revel, issues a sharp condemnation, arguing that the mechanism is not halakhically valid and warning that it could undermine the structure of Jewish marriage law more broadly. Very quickly, the debate is no longer only technical. It becomes symbolic, a symbolic dispute over who has legitimate authority to interpret and develop halacha. Mixed seating follows a similar trajectory. In the 19th century, Reformed Judaism had already eliminated separation between men and women in synagogue. By the early 20th century, some conservative rabbis begin to consider family seating as a practical response to American synagogue life and the challenge of retaining congregants. Many professors at JTS oppose the change, but rabbis in the field feel strong pressure from congregations trying to attract families and younger members. Some synagogues experiment with compromise arrangements, including setups that preserve partial separation alongside mixed seating sections. Over time, however, mixed seating becomes dominant in conservative synagogues. By the 1940s, it has effectively become standard practice. Orthodoxy, meanwhile, increasingly defines itself in opposition to this development. Movements such as Young Israel require separation between men and women, and both the Orthodox Union and Rabbinical Council of America publicly oppose mixed seating. Even when enforcement is uneven, the ideological line is becoming clearer and more explicit. By the 1950s, mixed seating is no longer just a synagogue practice. It becomes a marker of denominational identity. A real Orthodox synagogue increasingly comes to mean, in practice and perception, one that maintains a machitza. And with that, we return to the broader post-war transformation. In the 1940s and 1950s marked the moment when conservative Judaism fully moves away from Schechter's vision of a unified traditional Judaism and towards a self-conscious identity as a clear third denomination between Orthodoxy and Reform. A new generation of leaders no longer seeks to remain a broad coalition of traditional Jews. Instead, they aim to define conservative Judaism as an independent movement with its own boundaries, institutions, and halachic authority. This includes major institutional developments, the creation of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards in 1948, and the development of an authoritative prayer book that standardizes conservative religious life. And most significantly, in 1950, the movement rules that driving to synagogue and the use of electricity on Shabbos are permissible under certain conditions. At this point, conservative Judaism is no longer seeking Orthodox approval or operating within a shared halachic framework. It is functioning as an independent halachic authority in its own right. And this final institutional shift also reflects a deeper intellectual move, or the deeper intellectual move that we began with, a transition away from Schechter's Catholic Israel towards Frankel's positive historical school, where rabbinic authority is understood as actively shaping halacha within the ongoing process of historical development. But orthodoxy of the 1950s was weak. As historian Loris Grossman describes, this was a period of real insecurity. Many Orthodox leaders fear that orthodoxy may not survive in America. Conservative Judaism appeared more modern, more successful, and more compatible with suburban middle-class life. Orthodox synagogues often relied on older immigrant populations. Younger Jews were drifting away. Jewish education and infrastructure was still limited. Lawrence Grossman writes that Orthodox leaders were uncomfortable with the term Orthodox because it was first used as a negative term by early Reform Jews to portray their opponents as out of step with the times. Dr. Belkin, president of YU, preferred the term traditional as opposed to Orthodox. And in fact, in 1958, when the RCA began publication of a semi-scholarly journal, it bore the name Tradition, not Orthodox. In this environment, Orthodoxy faced the basic question: continue adapting or begin drawing clearer boundaries? Increasingly, the answer was boundaries. And here, the figure who most shaped that response was Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who became Rosh Yeshiva and Reitz in 1941. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not only strengthen modern Orthodoxy intellectually, he also changed how Orthodoxy understood itself in relation to conservative Judaism. He rejected conservative theology, but at the same time, he carefully distinguished between cooperation in public and communal matters and rejection in matters of religious legitimacy. Orthodoxy could work with other Jews, but it could not treat non-halachic movements as equally valid expressions of Judaism. This distinction became central to modern Orthodox self-definition. One of the clearest examples of the shift is mixed seating. In his public writings, Rabbi Soloveitchik argued strongly that mixed seating violated the integrity of Jewish prayer. But what is especially important is not only the ruling itself, it is what the ruling did over time. Mixed seating slowly stopped being just a synagogue practice. It became a boundary marker. It defined who was inside Orthodoxy and who was outside it. Earlier Orthodox rabbis might have tolerated or worked within such congregations. After Rav Soloveitchik's intervention, that became far more difficult to justify. This raises an interesting question. Was Rabbi Soloveitchik consciously trying to create denominational boundaries? The answer is not entirely clear. In fact, in the mid-1950s, he even engaged in discussions about possible cooperation with conservative institutions in certain areas. That suggests that he was not primarily thinking in denominational terms. His focus was on halacha, not sociology. He was trying to protect the integrity of tefillah and halacha, but the effect of his position was to strengthen denominational boundaries in practice. This is an important point. Sometimes boundaries are not created directly. They emerge as a byproduct of serious halachic decisions. By the end of this process, Orthodoxy had moved significantly away from its earlier posture. It was no longer primarily defined by broad affiliation or flexible accommodation. It was increasingly defined by clear standards, institutional development, and ideological self-definition. At the same time, even as boundaries hardened, some relations did not disappear. But by the middle of the 20th century, the development of conservative Judaism as an independent movement became one of the major factors pushing Orthodoxy to define its own boundaries more clearly. As conservative Judaism created its own halakhic institutions, synagogue standards, and approach to religious change, modern Orthodoxy increasingly responded by emphasizing clear definitions of Orthodox belief and practice. That shift significantly changed the role of the modern Orthodox rabbi. Early rabbis often focused primarily on maintaining affiliation and keeping Jews connected to the community, even in a religiously weak environment. But now the rabbi increasingly became responsible for strengthening commitment, building stronger Orthodox institutions, promoting halachic observance, expanding Jewish education, and cultivating a more self-conscious Orthodox identity. In many ways, the rise of conservative Judaism helped push the modern Orthodox rabbinate from a model of accommodation towards a model of boundary making and religious strengthening. And that sets the stage for the next chapter in the story. Once modern Orthodoxy becomes more institutionally secure and more clearly defined, a new question emerged. What exactly should modern Orthodoxy become? In our next lecture, we will explore that debate through two very different students of Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and two competing visions for the future of modern Orthodoxy in America.